Thanks, David. Yes, welcome back for the final part of Bach Day. So far, we've heard period instruments playing Bach's Brandenburg Concertos, we've heard Bach on the organ, and now it's time for Bach Day to really let its hair down with a whole concert of orchestrations from the beginning of the 20th century to the present day, including, in the great Proms tradition, two new commissions. This is Bach Transcribed in the company of the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and conductor Andrew Litton. Since the authentic performance movement, hearing Bach in these huge romantic orchestrations has become quite unfashionable. But then this repertoire has its own kind of authenticity, since we're hearing Bach through the ears of great musicians of the past, Walton, Henry Wood, Percy Grainger, Respighi, and perhaps the most famous Bach arranger of all, Leopold Stokowski. Well, you can find out more about all of them and their approach to Bach in the full programme notes, which are posted online right now, bbc.co.uk/proms. You can download them on your computer. And during the interval, you can hear a discussion that I had earlier on this afternoon about Bach orchestrations with tonight's conductor, Andrew Litton, and our two commissioned composers, Alyssa Firsova and Tarek O'Regan. To start, though, Leopold Stokowski and his celebrated orchestration of the organ toccata and fugue in D minor, which not only became hugely popular through Stokowski's own recording in 1927, but was iconically used in the Disney film Fantasia in 1940. That applause is for Cleo Gould leading the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra tonight at the BBC Proms in this grand culmination of Bach Day at the Proms. And following closely behind, Andrew Litton, to begin this evening's prom with Leopold Stokowski's orchestration of Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor.
Thank you.
Andrew Litton bringing the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra to their feet at the close of their first work in tonight's Bach Prom. Leopold Stokowski's orchestration of Bach's Organ Toccata and Fugue in D minor, BWV 565. A piece that the founder conductor of the Proms, Henry Wood, also arranged, but because he came under such criticism for his orchestral arrangements, he published it under a pseudonym, a Russian one, and didn't let slip about it until much later on. Well, Henry Wood's bust is peering over the orchestra from the back of the stage. And here come now the first and last movements from a suite for orchestra which Wood put together from Bach originals and was designed as one of two companion pieces to Bach's four existing orchestral suites. The finale of his suite, Sir Henry Wood took from the third solo violin partita, its Gigue, and we start with a prelude for keyboard from the Well-Tempered Clavier, the third from book one of that collection in C-sharp major, arranged for full orchestra. And don't forget, if you'd like to know more about tonight's programme, you can download the programme notes from the Proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms. Henry Wood was, of course, extremely keen to introduce new works to his audiences. He called them his novelties. We've been playing lots of them on the Radio 3 breakfast show, myself and my breakfast buddy Rob Cowan, which starts every morning at 7 o'clock. Well, coming back on stage now, Andrew Litton, to conduct the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in the prelude and finale from Sir Henry Wood's Orchestral Suite No. 6, taken from the music of Bach.
Thank you.
Sir Henry Wood, the founder, conductor of the Proms, his orchestration of Bach. Two movements, the outer movements of Wood's Orchestral Suite No. 6, intended as a companion suite to Bach's existing four orchestral suites. That was the prelude and the finale. Henry Wood, as I mentioned, talking about his novelties, was incredibly keen to get the music of Bach to a wider audience. And in those days, there weren't that many ways in which you could disseminate this kind of music, either through piano transcriptions, which people could play at home, or organ transcriptions and orchestrations. And Andrew Litton, tonight's conductor, was saying earlier that he basically never gets to conduct Bach, and it's pretty unfamiliar for a large orchestra like this. Well, we come now to the first of two composers who've been asked to, who've been commissioned to do their own arrangements for the orchestra of Bach this evening. The first is Tarik O'Regan, and he chose a solo violin work as his starting point, the Adagio opening of the C major violin sonata. He calls his piece Latent Manifest, that which is hidden, essentially revealed, and here he explains why.
As a solo violinist playing that Adagio movement, it's a sequence of four-part chords. Basically, and if you think about a violin, you can't play four notes at the same time. You have to make a decision as to how you're going to play those four notes. And that's fine if it's one or two chords, but when the entire sequence is made up of four-part chords, you're really beginning to change the dramatic nature, the rhythmic nature, and even the harmonic nature of the piece. So I listened to a vast number of interpreters of this particular movement going back maybe 40 years or so, and they often sound like completely different pieces of music. And it was really that hidden part of it, the part that's not written down on the page, the bit.
Thank you.
Latent Manifest, the world premiere of that BBC commission by Tarik O'Regan, taking as his starting point the Adagio opening movement of the solo violin sonata by Bach, number 3 in C major. And Tarik O'Regan making his way down the steps of the Royal Albert Hall onto the stage to shake hands with tonight's conductor, Andrew Litton, and also with Cleo Gould leading the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra tonight here at the Proms. Apologies that we had to cut short what Tarik O'Regan was saying just before that piece started, but we'll hear plenty more from him in the interval. He spoke to me earlier on with Andrew Litton and the other composer also commissioned to do a Bach arrangement tonight, Alyssa Firsova. You'll be able to hear that in the interval. But now Andrew Litton and the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra turn to the suite from William Walton's ballet, The Wise Virgins. Now, this is similar to the Henry Wood we heard earlier, in that it's a full suite made up of orchestrations of different Bach sources. In this case, it was fellow composer Constant Lambert who chose the bits of music, all of them movements from Bach cantatas and other choral works. The ballet, based on a parable from St. Matthew's Gospel, was choreographed for Sadler's Wells in 1940 by Frederick Ashton. Ninette Valois directed the production, and Margot Fonteyn danced the role of the bride. Well, the suite, 6 movements altogether, opens with Was Gott tut, das ist wohl getan. What God has done is rightly done, from Cantata number 99. Then from the St. Matthew Passion, that well-known chorale, Lord, hear my longing, is how Walton attributes that. Then a tenor aria from Cantata number 85, See What His Love Can Do. And then Ach, wie flüchtig, ah, how ephemeral, a chorus from Bach's Cantata number 26. That's followed by the much-loved Sheep May Safely Graze from Bach's first secular cantata with a lovely solo violin section for Cleo Gould, the leader of the RPO tonight. And it ends with the final chorus of cantata number 129, Praise Be to God. This is the Wise Virgin Suite by William Walton, taking music with cues from Bach. Andrew Litton conducts the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra.
Thank you.
Andrew Litton conducting the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in the Wise Virgins Suite. 6 works by Bach arranged for the orchestra by William Walton for Sadler's Wells Ballet in 1940. Closing there with the final chorus of Cantata number 129, Praise Be to God. And Andrew Litton's just motioning to Cleo Gould to stand. She opened Sheep May Safely Graze, the 5th movement of that suite, with the recitative. Flutes and oboes to their feet. And the trumpets too. Well, that's just the end of the first half of this evening's Bach arrangements from. More to come in the second half by Percy Grainger, Sir Malcolm Sargent, Granville Bantock and Respighi. And a brand new Bach arrangement by young composer Alyssa Firsova. Well, meanwhile, we're off to the Royal College of Music, where earlier on this afternoon I spoke to Alyssa and also to Andrew Litton and Tarika Reagan about Bach transcriptions and tonight's programme. Andrew Litton, I'd like to start by asking you, as you said earlier, what's a nice guy like you doing conducting a concert like this? By which you mean Bach is not your usual repertoire.
Not at all. I'm really chiefly known for music from 1850 to the present. So in other words, basically 100 years after Bach passed away. But this concert, of course, is Bach with a difference. And when I was asked to do this prom, I realized that actually it did fall under that purview, that mandate, because all of the music that we're doing tonight is written actually from 1900 to the present. So, and they're all big, romantic, incredibly passionate realizations of the music of Bach. So any resemblance to early instrument practice, so authentic instrument practice, and what you're going to hear tonight is, well, there isn't any. And all week I've been saying to the Royal Philharmonic, no, 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 lots of vibrato, slide between these two notes, because that's the sound world that these arrangers were actually living in. When you would do this monumental Pasquale fugue that Respighi arranged to end the concert, it's the most, well, one has to only think that he wrote Pines of Rome, that incredibly romantic outpouring 6 years earlier. So this is not a young composer trying his hand at learning the craft of orchestration by orchestrating a Bach work. This is the work of a very mature romantic composer, and the result is an absolutely gorgeous transcription of an organ piece that you'll also hear in today's today's Bach Day, which is fantastic. So the way I judge a great transcription or arrangement is if when you listen to it, you don't wish you were hearing the original, but that you really enjoy what you're hearing for what it is now. And I think we've done that with tonight's program.
Well, let's bring our two composers in then, Tarik and Alyssa. Alyssa, was that what you were aiming for when you transcribed Bach?
I think the great thing about transcriptions is a way of taking Bach on a time travel. I really try to put myself in his shoes and imagine how he would react to the modern world, how he would react to a huge size orchestra, which he never had access to. I wish he was here, and in a way, I'm sure he would be very interested to be here right now when anything is possible, and actually it's words that he really liked to say himself, that anything is possible. So I really tried to keep as much of his music there still, although went a bit crazy with the orchestration.
And while you keep as much of his music there as possible, Tarik, you do something slightly different in your piece. You almost orchestrate what's not there.
Yeah, very much. I think the thing, I mean, it's Bach Day, and I very much wanted to remember that Bach was much more than a composer. Obviously, he's a phenomenal composer, but he was a tremendous orchestrator himself, arranger, improviser, a performer. And it was really sort of looking at those aspects of Bach that we forget. I think if he were here today and you introduced him on stage along with us, I mean, we'd be, you know, kneeling at his feet. And you said, welcome, Bach, the composer, I think he'd look a little annoyed, perhaps, that we weren't referencing the other aspects of his life. And I really wanted to focus on those other areas. So for me, it was in many ways about performance and the way that, particularly in the piece that I orchestrated, the C major adagio from the solo violin sonatas, and having listened to a great variety of performers playing it, just how much Bach gives the performer in those pieces. It's much more than half the piece. And I was very interested in that half of the piece that isn't written down, the interpretation, the improvisation, really the role of that. And that's what I began orchestrating. So there are elements of Bach, but it very much goes off there. As Cleo Gould, the leader of the RPO, said, your piece goes a bit off-piste, doesn't it? So I'll leave that to you to judge.
Well, I rather suspect that Bach would have approved of off-piste. I mean, I was talking earlier on to the organist, David Briggs, who said Bach was such a modern man. You know, if he, for example, had at his disposal the organ in the Royal Albert Hall, he'd have been delighted. And do you think that's true? Do you think Bach would have approved of what's going to go on tonight?
Well, I think so. And I think he certainly was cutting edge. I mean, he set the level for so many people for such a long period of time. I mean, he's still the Shakespeare of music, I think, yeah. For a lack of a better way to simplify and quantify what I'm trying to say. So his influence is immeasurable, and it's constant. So, of course, if he suddenly were able to come back and speak to us now, I think, A, he'd be thrilled at what the BBC has done for him today, and B, I think he'd absolutely be gobsmacked by this ability to use this massive orchestra and create all these sounds. I'm sure that somewhere in his imagination he had, you know, a dream that maybe there could be sounds like this one day, but there's absolutely no way, even with a crystal ball, that he could have seen what you're going to see at this concert tonight or what you're going to hear. What I love is both of our young composers have taken the size orchestra that the bookends of this program, the Stokowski arrangement and the Respighi arrangement, massive orchestras, and they've had this toy to play with, and they've made very good use of these huge forces. It's got to be a lot of fun for you guys to have, because usually you get a commission, and if you're lucky, it's double wins. And
well, no,
you
know. It's tremendous. I ought to say, if Bach were here today, I think he'd be pretty happy with his royalty check.
Yeah.
But apart from that, it's the thing I was thinking about listening to the rehearsals. It's a really wonderful, with the exception of the Respighi, which is wonderful in its own right. The rest of the work. It's a wonderful survey of British symphonic writing. And I really, when you hear this concert tonight and when you listen to the program, do engage with it as an example of where the symphony orchestra has been at the beginning of the 20th century and where it grew. And there's an authenticity to itself, which is not the wonderful work of John Elliott Gardner, and it's not the wonderful work of early music and authenticity with regard to the Baroque. But think of it as a different kind of authenticity. When there was a period where we thought Bach was very much the progenitor of symphonic writing, and dare I say, people like Malcolm Sargent thought he could improve upon Bach's orchestrations and make them bigger and more wonderful. But it's a really incredible survey of where people thought music in the 20th century came from, what needed to be drawn out from the music of the past. And that, to be part of that as a British composer, working with, you know, the RPO and Andrew, is a real honour, and it's really fascinating to take a tiny, small piece of the puzzle. But do engage with that. I think it's something to listen out for.
Andrew, I was going to ask you about that question of authenticity. Do you feel when you're conducting this program that you're conducting Bach, or you're conducting Stokowski, Henry Wood?
Yeah, the latter, actually. I mean, and that's really the approach as I mentioned, that I took with the orchestra from the first minutes of the first rehearsal. We started rehearsing the Stokowski, and in preparation for, you know, realizing my interpretation, I went back and found the video of Fantasia, which I hadn't screened in years since my kids were tiny, and I actually put it on, and I was watching. I was able to discern some interesting bowings through the scrim, because you know, there's of course just Stokowski's back as he's conducting this, amazing orchestral playing and incredible colors. And then somebody gave me a live performance with the Cleveland Orchestra. Now remember, Stokowski's orchestra had been Philadelphia, but it's Cleveland Orchestra from 1971. So just barely out of the clutches of George Sell, with, you know, an orchestra renowned for its linear sound and its kind of clear, clean sound. Well, you put this recording on, and it sounds like the Philadelphia Orchestra string section, you know. So he clearly had this way to transform any orchestra he stood before to whatever sound world he wanted. But the sound world he wanted, obviously, from these two performances that are over 30 years apart, is this big, gushy sound, and you know, lots of string attack. And I said, you know, the first note that we play in this concert has to almost hit the audience like this. And that's where you're all going to know that this is not your grandmother's Bach. This is vegetarians stay away.
But for some reason, Bach, more than any other composer, his music seems to lend itself to arrangement and transcription. Alyssa, what is it about the music that makes that possible? Do you think there is an essence of the music which allows for that kind of, you know, myriad transformation?
Well, it just seems that his music is so pure that it can be interpreted in so many different ways. I think that we live in a time now where there isn't only one correct way of doing something, and we've broken away from all of the concentration on historical performance. And obviously transcriptions is a way to get away from that. And it seems what people are looking for is something different. And it's incredible how Bach has inspired so many different styles of music too. I mean, so much jazz and swing singers and Bobby McFerrin, and the list just goes on and on.
And Bossa Nova Bach. My personal favorite.
Well, yeah. Is that what's on your iPod then? Yes.
Yeah, all three albums.
But it's an interesting, that all, you know, the many, many contemporary ways in which Bach is interpreted. I know I present the Radio 3 Breakfast Show, and sometimes my colleague and I, Rob Cowan, play the odd arrangement or transcription, and sometimes people write in saying, you know, stop massacring Bach. So there are still those who want pure, unadulterated Bach. I mean, how do you think we're really coming to a point now where this Stokowski tradition is not going to be quite so unfashionable as it has been in the last 50 years?
Definitely. I think the pendulum always swings back. And since in my lifetime, we've gone from Bach with vibrato and slides, as I mentioned, and played at A440, to this really authentic, you know, what we're led to believe this is really what it sounded like when Bach was alive. So gut strings and playing at a lower pitch. And now, you know, I think we've all been there, done that. And I think, in a way, it's nice to go and have an evening like tonight where we can all let our hair down and go, wow, isn't this fun? And the thing is, the basic music is so, they're such masterpieces, all of the works, that there's nothing that can be done to really hurt them, especially when the instrument in question is a fantastic symphony orchestra. So, you know, we haven't necessarily added anything strange to Bach, but what I love is what these two young people surrounding me have done with the concept of this program. I mean, Alyssa's piece, from the first note, you're going to have a smile on your face, because it's just there's something so joyous about the way she treats this piece, and some extraordinary percussion effects that are, you know, you can just imagine what Bach would have thought of flexitone during one of his pieces, but there it is, and it works. You know, so I think this, because Bach was so pure in his own way. His musical thoughts are so basic and succinct and perfect, if you will. Anything can be done to them, in a way. And if you put together a program like this with really good arrangements, I think Bach wins in the end.
And the other thing to remember is that, of course, Bach was a great arranger himself, great orchestrator and arranger, notably Vivaldi, but also his own work. He'd go and redo it. And in many ways, it wasn't what you'd expect as a straight arrangement. It would often turn into a fantasia. The piece I worked with, I know that he orchestrated or reworked for harpsichords, and it actually bears very little relation to the original. And you think, in some ways, that he'd approve. You know, I feel that I have the tacit approval of Bach, whereas I feel if this were Beethoven Day, it would be altogether different, and I'd probably be in a lot of trouble from the great man himself. But there's something, I mean, going back to what I said earlier, I think there's something about the fact that he did so many aspects of being a musician. He was involved in so many different roles of being a musician, and I've said it before, I feel that he was the gigging musician, the original gigging musician who had to go and write and compose and arrange and conduct and improvise and walk 400 miles to go and hear some improvisation, the rest of it. You feel that he was really into the robustness of the music, and it can survive anything. And when you think back to classic interpretations of Bach, I was thinking of Glenn Gould, which is, of course, wholly unauthentic when it first came out. But I feel that there's sort of a slight return to that, in that Glenn Gould, of course, writing for an instrument that wasn't really around in Bach's day, with complete and utter wacky tempos, even singing along to the music. But it survived and became, you know, and for many people around the world, re-engaged them with Bach. And of course, that's just before the beginning of the authenticity movement of the late 50s and 60s. So I very much agree with and think about what you just said about the pendulum swinging. And it's a curious program. I don't think you could have done it 5 years ago. But today, I feel there's such a magic to hearing what you've done with the orchestra, and just hearing this material in a way that is, for me, it's utterly authentic. It's utterly authentic to the spirit of the great man.
It's been really a fun week putting this program together with the orchestra, because they don't play this music at all. And as we've already said, I never have conducted any of this music before. So, you know, it's very unusual to get a situation where neither the orchestra or the conductor have ever done any of the pieces on the program before. Obviously, the two world premieres I'm allowed, but the rest, so, you know, usually there's a symphony that everybody knows, and so you don't have to. So really, we used every second of rehearsal time, because it was starting from scratch.
But presumably that leaves you free.
Oh, not only free, but also what's great is the orchestra really has embraced the challenge, you know? It's not another Tchaikovsky Fifth, even though it's one of my favorite pieces. Don't write letters, please. It's you know, it's the whole idea that from the word go, this is different, this is off the beaten path, has created a certain kind of frisson, kind of excitement around there, which is really fun to be a part of.
Alyssa, when you started on your transcription, did you feel like there was a kind of performance tradition or a tradition of transcriptions which you needed to fall in line with, or did you also feel very free?
I think I felt a lot of freedom, and I was very inspired by some of the Schoenberg arrangements, the St. Anne's Prelude and Fugue. In particular, seeing as he just takes the music and makes it into a piece of his own in some way. With the orchestration, and at the same time, the other thing I really wanted to say with my piece, to try and say that Bach, no matter how immortal he will always be to us and what a god of music he is, he was also a human being, surprisingly. I don't know how he did it, but I'm sure he also had a sense of humor, as well as being very serious and very dedicated to his work in a completely sacred way. So I decided to completely focus on that with my transcription, to try and make it as humorous as possible. And I confess I laughed all the way through the rehearsal myself when I heard it, so I really hope that it's going to cause a similar reaction in the audience.
What is your one Bach Desert Island disc?
Well, it's easy for me, and Tarek's already mentioned it, Glenn Gould's Goldberg Variations.
Very much related to this, and I've been living with these recordings. I've been listening to a variety of recordings of the six sonatas, partitas for solo violin, and the one that I'm drawn to increasingly is Alina Ibragimova. There's something in her performance, I can't tell you exactly what it is, but it's very much to do with the idea of a performer taking a compositional role in this Bach piece.
Well, my choice would definitely be the Bach Double Violin Concerto with David Oistrakh and his son, Igor Oistrakh. Just one of my favorite pieces of music. It's a very beautiful family recording, a family union. And you can really hear that in their playing. It's really fantastic.
My thanks to all three of you, to Alyssa Fiersova, Andrew Litton, and Tarika Regan.
Thank you, sir.
Well, the four of us recorded that Proms Plus event in the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall in the Royal College of Music, just across the road from the Royal Albert Hall, and it was produced by Janet Tappan. Well, welcome back now to the Royal Albert Hall for the last leg of our journey. Today, Bach Day at the Proms. And this evening, the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra are treating us to Bach transcriptions from the 20th and 21st centuries. We heard Andrew Litton say then, "This is not your grandmother's Bach." Well, to come this evening, we'll begin with Percy Grainger's Blithe Bells, then one of Sir Malcolm Sargent's arrangements of Bach, and following that, Alyssa Fiersova's Bach Allegro, which we heard her talk about, a truly joyful piece. And then if you were listening earlier on to David Briggs giving an organ recital at 5 o'clock this afternoon, you'll be familiar with the music that we'll hear towards the close of this evening's concert. An arrangement of Wachet Auf, Sleepers Wake by Bantok, and then Respighi's orchestration of the great Passacaglia and Fugue in C minor, which David Briggs opened his organ recital with this afternoon. In fact, if you miss that organ recital, or indeed John Elliott Gardiner directing the Brandenburg Concertos, you will of course be able to listen again to them online for 7 days following broadcast. Just go to the Radio 3 website, bbc.co.uk/Radio 3. If you want to know more about tonight's programme, a reminder that you can download programme notes on the Proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms. It's interesting also to have a little search through the Proms archive while you're on the Proms website and find out perhaps when many of these pieces were first heard at the Proms. Many of what we're hearing tonight are the first Proms performance of these particular orchestrations. In fact, while you're there, you could also have a go at the Proms quiz, although I do warn you, it's extremely addictive. Well, as I mentioned, we have two pieces to start by Percy Grainger and Sir Malcolm Sargent, who was Henry Wood's successor as chief conductor of the Proms. Sir Malcolm Sargent, as a conductor, wasn't afraid to tinker with music. He added in extra percussion parts for added effect in 19th century symphonies, for example. And we're going to hear a movement from his orchestration of Bach's third orchestral suite, the most recognisable movement of all, the so-called Air on a G-string. Again, a reprise of a work which we heard David Briggs play earlier on the organ. But the first piece is by the Australian composer Percy Grainger, one of the most inventive arrangers of them all. He made several versions of a piece which he called Blithe Bells, or to give it its full title, A Free Ramble on Sheep May Graze in Safety, or as we know it better, Sheep May Safely Graze. And this, of course, is the orchestral version, which we'll hear played at the Royal Albert Hall by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Their leader tonight, the violinist Cleo Gould. Applause for Andrew Litton, who conducts the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in Percy Grainger's Blithe Bells. There's no arranger quite like Percy Grainger. That was Blythe Bell's Percy Grainger's take on Sheep May Safely Graze by Bach. And next, the RPO, conducted by Andrew Litton, performed the air on a G-string.
Thank you.
The famous air from Bach's orchestral suite number 3 in D major, known as the air on a G string. That arrangement was by Sir Malcolm Sargent, who succeeded Sir Henry Wood as chief conductor of the Proms after Wood's death in 1944. Well, welcome if you've just tuned in to BBC Radio 3. You're listening live to the Proms from the Royal Albert Hall with me, Sarah Moore-Peach. We're here for the final leg of our journey on Proms Bach Day. Now, arranging Bach is nothing new at all. Mozart and Mendelssohn did it, Schoenberg and Webern too. And as Andrew Litton mentioned earlier to me, you don't get to be a musician without playing Bach, even if, as an orchestral conductor as he is, you don't really get to conduct Bach that often. Well, two young composers have been commissioned for this evening's prom to make their own arrangements of Bach's music, and we come now to our second, the young Alyssa Firsova. Incidentally, she was one of the very first winners of the BBC Proms Young Composers Competition 10 years ago. Both her parents, too, are composers from Russia, Elena Firsova and Dmitry Smirnov. Well, as we heard Alyssa mention earlier in the 20 minutes interval feature, she takes her starting point in Bach's Viola da Gamba Sonata, the final movement of the Sonata number 3 in G minor, and she calls her piece Bach Allegro. It's interesting, she says, to put yourself in Bach's shoes and imagine how he would react if he travelled through time into our world and was faced with a 100-piece orchestra. She hopes that you'll have a smile on your face from the very first note. The piece opens with a bang and ends with fireworks as it celebrates the life of Bach and the Bach Day. So the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra on stage and tuned, their leader tonight, Cleo Gould, awaiting Andrew Litton. Here he comes now to conduct the world premiere of a BBC Radio 3 Proms commission by Alyssa Firsova. This is Bach Allegro.
Thank you.
Well, the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall definitely enjoyed hearing that for the very first time. The world premiere of Bach Allegro by Alyssa Firsova. Her full-blown orchestration of the final movement of Bach's Viola da Gamba Sonata No. 3 in G minor, a commission for this year's Proms Bach Day. So Alyssa Firsova has descended the steps of the stalls of the Royal Albert Hall, and she's standing on the conductor's podium now, taking a bow. Shaken the hands of both conductor Andrew Litton and lead violinist tonight with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, Cleo Gould. Alyssa said she was partly drawn to that piece because it might well have been a sketch for another concerto to be included in the Brandenburg set, a possible Brandenburg 7. So a nice link back to where we began our Bach Day earlier on this afternoon. But now we're going to end our night with orchestral arrangements of the two pieces by Bach that started the afternoon celebrations in the hall, both of them played in their original on the organ of the Royal Albert Hall by David Briggs. And the first is the much-loved chorale prelude Wachet auf, based on the chorale melody we know as Sleeper's Wake. And this arrangement is by Granville Bantock. Vaughan Williams was a big admirer of Bantock's. What Bantock did not know about orchestration is not worth knowing, he said. Bantock orchestrated this piece in 1910, and it was the first of three arrangements of it he made. The others were for the pianist Harriet Cohen, and finally, right towards the end of his life in the 1940s, he made a brass band arrangement of Wachet auf. Well, looking back again to earlier on in this evening's concert, we heard a Bach orchestration by Sir Henry Wood, whose bust peers over the back of the orchestra. Of course, he was the chief conductor of the Proms for many years and one of the founders of it. And we'll be paying tribute to him later on in the Proms season on the 5th of September. Henry Wood Day recreates the last night of the Proms 100 years ago, which was conducted by Sir Henry Wood. But now the applause is for the conductor, Andrew Litton, making his way on stage to conduct the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in Wachet auf, arranged by Granville Bantock.
Thank you.
Wachet auf, ruft uns die Stimme. Sleepers wake. The chorale prelude by Bach, orchestrated by dear old Gran, as Elgar called him. Granville Bantock, magazine editor and conductor of opera and choirs and light music, and also professor of music in his day in Birmingham. Well, finally, a work we're hearing again for the second time today. We heard it at 5 o'clock in its original, played on the organ here in the Albert Hall by David Briggs. We come now to the magnificent orchestration by Italian composer Respighi of Bach's Passacaglia and Fugue in C minor for organ. 20 variations on an 8-bar bass, which opens the work. A real showpiece in its original for organ, and the same in its treatment by Respighi for orchestra, which he made in 1930. And with all of these familiar works by Bach that we're hearing in orchestrations, it's a wonderful chance to be able to focus on the orchestration itself, the subtle and also sometimes not so subtle touches that the composers and conductors who've made these arrangements add in. Conductor Andrew Litton returns to the stage of the Albert Hall for one last time this evening to close Bach Day with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra and Respighi's arrangement of the Passacaglia and Fugue in C minor by Bach. That is a real masterpiece of inventive orchestration from 1930 by the Italian composer Respighi. His take on the Passacaglia in Fugue in C minor, originally for organ by Bach, performed live here at the BBC Proms in the Royal Albert Hall by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Litton. We've come rather full circle since the organ recital by David Briggs, which began at 5 o'clock this afternoon with that very piece played in its original on the organ. And a lovely touch of Respighi is that he actually leaves the organ in his orchestration. Not an awful lot to do, but tonight's organist, John Birch, his legs working away at the pedals. The Juilliard-trained conductor Andrew Litton is back on stage, and he's bringing section by section of the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra to their feet. We've had a real feast of Bach at the Proms today, in this year's Bach Day. I'm almost sad to say that those were the last notes of Bach that we're going to hear in this Proms season, but I think we're probably all fully sated. But the Proms, of course, do not finish here. In fact, I was reliably informed by somebody who's very good with numbers that the organ recital, the previous Prom to this, was the halfway point of the BBC Proms, so much more music to look forward to. Tomorrow evening, we have a slightly earlier start than usual of 6:30. The London Philharmonic Orchestra with Vladimir Yurovsky start their programme with another arrangement, Rimsky-Korsakov's orchestration of Mussorgsky's Night on the Bear Mountain. And also in that programme, violinist Julia Fischer is the soloist in Shostakovich's long-suppressed first violin concerto. And they close the evening tomorrow at the Proms with the Third Symphony by Prokofiev. So that's all to look forward to tomorrow evening. And as the RPO brought to their feet for a final time by conductor Andrew Litton here at the Proms, it's good night from me, Sarah Moore-Peach, but I'm handing you on to Broadcasting House for the rest of the evening here on Radio 3, and over to David Cornett. David.
Thank you very much indeed, Sarah. And another chance, of course, to hear tonight's Prom on Thursday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. And if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's Prom, or indeed of our whole Bach Day, then please visit bbc.co.uk/proms and click on Share. Well, we have just over half an hour to go before our next programme, which is Between the Ears. The temptation, of course, is to listen to some more Bach, but I think Sarah's right. We are sated with it, and jolly good stuff, though, it is. And I'm bearing in mind Shakespeare's words about blunting the fine point of seldom pleasure. So we'll move on, and we'll hear music by Rimsky-Korsakov. This is his Capriccio Espagnol in an arrangement for two pianos played by Arturo Pizarro and Vita Panomariovita. Thank you. arrangement for two pianos of Capriccio Espanol by Rimsky-Korsakov, played by Arto Pizzaro and Vita Pano Mario Vita. Well, coming up next here on BBC Radio 3 at 10 o'clock, which is still 14-15 minutes away, is Between the Ears, an edition called Melting Point, which you may have heard before, but another chance to hear it tonight. Nina Perry's musical environmental soundscape it is, exploring the emotional resonance of melting ice in Greenland, Iceland and the Highlands of Scotland as winter turns to spring. So that's at 10 o'clock. More piano music now, though, this time played by duo Scaramouche, and this is Grieg's Norwegian Dances. Absolutely exhausting. Norwegian Dances by Grieg, played by duo Scaramouche.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
And back to this evening. It's coming up to 4 minutes past 10. Now on BBC Radio 3, Between the Ears. And this week we have another chance to hear Melting Ice by the composer and feature maker Nina Perry. It visits the icy landscapes of Greenland, Iceland and the Highlands of Scotland to explore the cultural, environmental and musical significance of the thaw from winter into spring. This is Melting Point.
Snjókorn í lófa Að vatni ertu komið Og að vatni skal þú aftur verða
Ilulissat is situated in North Greenland, just near the most productive ice fjord in the world. Like 300 kilometers north from the polar circle.
So we are in the true Arctic.
I can tell from my eyes now that there are two icebergs that are not dangerous, but one iceberg that is dangerous. If you think of, maybe I can give you the picture. You have big castle look like buildings with high towers, and you could have icebergs looking like that with high towers and thin towers. They are dangerous, but they can break off anytime and anywhere. So never go close to it. If it breaks off, you will have a big, very big building banging into the water just near you, and you will disappear immediately. You have big icebergs that are very solid with no towers, just like an ice cube, just in a billion size bigger. That is very solid, and you can go near it, sometimes walk on it. It's prohibited to walk on it, but it's very rare that they destroy. They kind of just melt down into small pieces. But the icebergs with the different funny shapes and an iceberg with an iceberg upon it, it keeps melting in the sun, and it will get a shape which gives it unbalance, and when it's an unbalance, it either tips off or roll around. So stay away from those and stay to the very solid icebergs with no funny shapes.
when you look at the mountains in summer, they can be beautiful. In winter, they're just incredible. It's a magical time of year when the weather conditions are nice, and it's a really challenging place when the weather isn't so good, when it's more Scottish in character. Coming from the Cairngorms, we have lots of noise from wind in the mountains, and you get used to listening for it coming before it actually hits you. So you kind of build up a sixth sense almost of hearing the weather.
So how are we doing with the harness?
That's a bit twisted there.
There's blue ice, there's green ice, there's brittle ice, toffee ice, there's sort of snow ice, nevy. Scottish ice climbing is notoriously scary because it's frozen snow rather than water ice. Some people will describe it as squeaky nevy, where you get enough grip, but you can't protect it. It's good to climb on, it squeaks away, but in terms of putting ice screws in, you just don't think or feel they're going to hold if you should fall off, so you can't fall off them. That's the top thought in your mind.
So your 8-foot sling today, we can keep that on our harness.
We teach people to listen to what their feet are doing in the snow and listen to the snow itself. And if it's creaky, it tells you things about how well bonded it is or how different the snow crystals are from an avalanche point of view. You know, when it's crunchy, crisp snow, sometimes that tells you about how good your grip is with your crampons or your feet. Experiences of spending lots of time on glaciers, they make a huge amount of noise. And if you've ever spent time trying to sleep in a tent, lying on a glacier, it makes all sorts of booms and echoes and funny noises, and you think you're about to fall down a crevasse all the time.
I'm a geologist working in glaciers. And I've been to a glacier which has played music for me that I have nowhere else heard. It is an extreme range of vibration from very, very high pitch, even beyond what you hear, and to a very, very low vibration where you don't hear it with your ears, you just feel it with your guts. Also, you hear the fractured ice, shattered ice, moving in heaps. Sounds like glass crystal being pushed forward by something. It's a thumping heartbeat of the glacier, very regular. Sofðu unga ástin mín, úti regnið grætur. Mamma geymir gullin þín, gamla leggi og völuskrín. Við skulum ekki vakum dimmar nætur. Það er margt sem myrkrið veit, minnir hugur þungur. Oft ég svartan sandin leit, svíða grænan engireit. Í jöklinum hljóða dauða djúpar sprungur. In the glacier, the deadly deep crevasses are mourning. A lullaby that's sung for every child in Iceland. Sleep, my dear beloved one, outside the rain is crying. Mother keeps your playthings.
Old sheep legs and muscle shells.
We shall not
be
awake during the dark night. There are many things that darkness knows.
My mind is
dark,
heavy. Many times I saw the black sand advance over the green meadow. And in the glacier,
the deadly deep crevasses
are moaning.
This doesn't sound like soothing for any young child.
We have this realistic view on life. We don't avoid grief and the real sadness in life, which creeps up on everyone. Times were hard in Iceland back then, when people had to actually carry out their children because they couldn't keep them, they couldn't take care of them. The mother makes sure the baby is asleep and it's in her arms when it dies, and that is the most important thing. Sleep now softly, sleep soundly. Late is best to waken. Troubles soon will teach you, as each day quickly passes, that people love, lose, cry, and mourn. It's very cold, it's dark. But what is warm in this is the mother's love.
Sometimes it does go horribly wrong and there is a risk involved. When we come up against it from a rescue point of view, I think you're very focused on getting the job done. I don't have a lot of space in my head thinking about other things in those occasions. It's afterwards that you maybe find yourself back in an area where there's been a fatal accident. And the feelings, the emotions are evoked then. Now, if I come back off the mountains and I feel emotional or sad about it, I'll pick up my fiddle and I'll play slow airs and laments. I think to try and get out of the system as well. You think you maybe play happy tunes, but you tend to play sad tunes. It's very much the mood that you're in. It's maybe part of the grieving process, I don't know. You know, although we might not know the person, you still definitely go through that sort of process that, well, you know, we did the best we could, but they didn't make it.
Being still is a protective process and a very natural one. When grief occurs, it's a huge shock. And one of the things about shock is that our bodies freeze. So part of work as a drama therapist is supporting the person in their own time to unfreeze. As part of my job, I do a lot of training of other professionals. And I was looking for a way of introducing a metaphor. With the exercise, I simply say, I'm going to pass two cubes of ice around, one this way, one that way. And I'll invite and encourage people just to hold it for a few moments, notice how they're feeling, what's it like to have it in their hands, and then when they're ready, just pass it on. And I don't mention what the ice has been about. I simply say, what was it like to pass the ice, to hold the ice? Quite often, people make very direct connections and say, oh, it's about death, isn't it? It's about loss. Sometimes people say it was cold, it was slipping through my fingers, it was messy, I didn't like it. With a healthy grief process, one would hope that there would be a cycle, that there would be moments of being frozen, moments of moving on, moments of new growth. And that often seems agonisingly slow, or that that's not happening. But usually it does.
Snjókorn í lófa. Að vatni ertu komið og að vatni skal þú aftur verða.
Greenland is like a very big bathtub. So therefore you can only live in the coasts. The coast is that limits the bathtub. When we get snow in the winter, the snow will fall on the inland ice, and it keeps falling and keeps falling, and in the end it pressures the ice out from the ice fjords and gletschers. You can imagine if you fill your bathtub up with water, and the water will fall out of the bathtub in the end because it's full. It's actually the same system with the inland ice.
We can see in the Greenland glacier when the Romans invented the plumbing system, because there was a lot of lead melted and somewhat went into the atmosphere and fell on the surface of the glacier in Greenland, among other things. If it happens in the northern hemisphere, it will be caught up in the Greenland ice cap. The Greenland ice sheet is solid frozen by many minus degrees centigrade. So if you have a soluble material fall on the Greenland glacier, it stays put in that stratigraphy. If you have something soluble fall on an Icelandic glacier, it's like putting milk in a cup of coffee. It'll just spread all through the body in a very short time. Icelandic glaciers are temperate. They're always at the melting point. They're wet all through.
Snowflake in a palm. From water you are to water you become. I'm an Icelandic writer. There's an Icelandic photographer. He has been photographing faces and monsters and images and ice that was calving into this lake in the south coast of Iceland. He asked me, what are these pictures telling us? What do these faces mean? What is this?
Down through the strata of the glacier, we can extract history if we know how to interpret. And we are getting to know it. We can tell by measuring the ratio of isotopes, what the temperature was like during any given period. So it has memory in a very real sense.
So I was looking at these pictures for some time, and I was wondering how old this ice was that was calving into this lake, and found out that the ice was about 800 years old, and therefore the images and the memory of this water would have been from a notorious era in the Icelandic history. We had our only war in Iceland at that time.
Everything that goes into the glacier will come out of it. We had an airplane crashing into a glacier in the year 1952. It appeared at the snout of that glacier in 1995, with crew and everything. But it was not intact, of course. We had an arm with a wedding ring and a watch there and a wallet, and it was pretty much preserved, but shattered to pieces anyway.
In the 1200s, it kind of came imbalance, where instead of tens and hundreds of independent farmers, they became mega clans and super chiefs. Just a few guys acquired almost all the power of our business community. So I was wondering if this ice that was calving into the lake contained maybe some kind of memories, and if this was actually entering our drinking water, it could explain the collapse and what happened to the Icelandic businessmen.
We have another airplane that crashed into a glacier, much larger glacier, in 1950. Now it is at 200 meters depth in the glacier, and it's moving slowly towards the edge of this glacier. If the glacier stay the similar size, it'll appear at the terminus of the glacier in about 600 or 800 years. But now we are expecting that the glaciers will melt altogether in about 200 years. Then this history of 2,000 years that we have embedded within the glacier is going to melt away in 200 years, so we are losing 5 years of history every year now.
When an iceberg destroys, turn around or fall in pieces, there will always be billions of very small pieces suitable for a ice cube into a glass of whiskey. You can hear the bubbles inside the ice cubes. When you hear them melt, you can hear them crackle, because that air bubble is made like 2 to 3 million years ago.
It's certainly melting pretty rapidly today up in the Cairngorms. So I was listening to water running down off rocks and disappearing into the snowpack, which wasn't a good thing when you're perched on snow on top of rock, you know, and you think, I really don't want to be here anymore. It's time to hang up the ice axe for a while and let it freeze up. I hope that cold conditions return. It gets to a stage where you've had enough of snow and ice. The little flowers are coming out and the grass is changing to green again from sort of brown. And the thought that, yeah, we can go out and feel a bit of warmth in the springtime. So it's a fresh time of year, it's a nice transition.
That power is quite overwhelming, really, when you kind of stand on the cliff and it just comes endlessly without stopping. And this roar is kind of almost seductive. Many people that I know express the feeling of they want to jump into it, vanishing into the power and the roar, yes.
We are going 5 minutes from here. The fish is just outside town.
I don't think there are any humans who have seen greater increase in water discharge than the people in southern Iceland, ever. During eruptions in the Mýrdalsjökull ice cap, we have the floodings getting way beyond the discharge of the Amazon River. So during that moment, the largest river in the world is in Iceland. We call it Jökulhlaups, catastrophic. There will be a huge change in the landscape when the glaciers are gone. Now things are changing very drastically. Increase of 1 degree centigrade is huge. We are expecting several degrees centigrades warming up. And this has so much impact that we really have no way of telling exactly what will happen.
When ice came in the winter here before, we could hunt seals on the ice and we could hunt beluga whales. But today it's not possible. Today we've